Survivor's Guide to True Crime includes discussions of sexually based violence and is not intended for children. Information provided should not be used as a substitute for professional medical or legal advice. Please exercise discretion and self-care. Welcome back to Survivor's Guide to True Crime. I'm Kim.
I'm Kara. And today we are talking to one of my friends, Elizabeth Smart. I just love her and I think she has such an amazing presence. I'm sure you've heard the story of Elizabeth. The abduction of Elizabeth Smart was one of the most followed child abduction cases of our time.
Elizabeth was abducted on June 5th, 2002, and her captors controlled her by threatening to kill her and her family if she tried to escape.
Fortunately, the police safely returned Elizabeth back to her family on March 12, 2003, after being held a prisoner for 9 grueling months.
Through this traumatic experience, Elizabeth has become an advocate for change related to child abduction, recovery programs, and national legislation.
Elizabeth triumphantly testified before her captor and the world about the very private nightmare she suffered during her abduction, which led to conviction.
The founder of the Elizabeth Smart Foundation, Elizabeth has also helped promote the National Amber Alert, the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act, and other safety legislation to help prevent abductions.
Smart attended Brigham Young University, studying music as a harp performance major. She married her husband Matthew in 2012, and they now have 3 beautiful children.
Elizabeth's example is a daily demonstration that there really is life after tragedy, and Kara, I know that she has been a huge influence in your life.
Absolutely. I can genuinely say that I would not be who I am and where I am today were it not for her influence and her guidance. And I cannot wait for you guys to hear this conversation. I think it's really genuine, and I hope that you'll have some takeaways and some tips to help you go forward in harnessing your strength and how to talk to your children and how to talk to others and how to advocate for the people that you care about.
Thank you so much for joining us today. I am so honored to have this opportunity to meet you. I feel like I know you through Kara and your relationship and just getting to talk to Kara so much, but please help me in welcoming Elizabeth Smart.
Yay!
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, we're so glad to have you. And I have known you for how many years have we known each other now? Maybe 7? Does that sound right?
I think it's been about that. Yeah, actually.
Yeah, because I think you were pregnant with your second, maybe like very, very early when I first met you.
That could totally be right.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think.
Tell us a little bit about how you guys met.
Yeah. So at the time, I was a contributor to the TV show Crime Watch Daily, and Kara's story had been put in front of me, and I was asked, oh, you know, what do you think of this story? Does this story, like, does it resound with you? Like, what does it make you feel? Like, it was very much like, what do you think of this story? How do you feel about this story? Would you be okay going after this story? And I read the story, and I was like, holy cow, this woman is badass. Of course I want to go talk to her. Like, she's incredible. For me, I would say it was more sort of like love at first sight. And I've just been a Kara fan ever since.
You are the sweetest. And, you know, the funny thing for me is that at that point, I had kind of stepped back from sharing my story because I had had many negative experiences sharing my story with various outlets and them kind of taking it and running with it and changing things. And so I had stepped back from it and I thought, okay, this is my time to kind of raise my kids. And I got an email from the sheriff because it went through the sheriff's department, the request. And he said, Elizabeth Smart would like to interview you. And I said, that I would do. You know, I don't want to do any of these other things, but I'll do that one because I knew instantly that the negative experiences that I had had previously, I would not experience with you because you would understand these moments of someone trying to kind of weave your story into something that they wanted it to be instead of it being authentic to what you experienced. And I remember sitting down in that interview and the moment that was all confirmed when I said, you know, that look that people give you, Elizabeth, when they find out your story, and you went, oh, I know the look. And I was like, this is it. This is what it means to sit down with someone who truly understands what you've gone through. And I mean, it honestly changed the course of my life, like that moment. And it gave me a lot of purpose and drive of what I wanted to do. And then when we were able to sit down on the couch for the Smart Talks discussion with the other survivors, Could you tell us a little bit about how that came about? Because I think that was one of the most powerful things that I've ever been a part of.
Now, I feel like we have sat down on a couple of couches with a couple of different survivors. Are you referring to the one that was on TV? Are you referring to the one that was at the summit? Are you referring to the one where I interviewed you for my podcast?
That is true. I am specifically talking about the one where we were supporting Jamie Kloss, where there were seven of us, right? And we were in that studio recording for like at least six hours, I think, on that couch, right?
You know, I honestly can't even remember. It's a big memory, but I also feel like I was so emotionally invested in that moment that it seemed to go by very fast for me.
Yeah, it did.
So, I mean, there were for sure stressful moments there. I'd be lying if I said it was just easy peasy. It definitely wasn't. But I felt very emotionally invested in that moment. And I think part of it was why it was so special, I guess, for me personally, was because, you know, up until that moment, I had never seen a group of survivors coming together publicly and talking, mm-hmm. sharing experiences and kind of talking about the transition that you go from victim to survivor and moving forward with your life. And I felt like that was so impactful for me because when I was rescued, and even before I was rescued, I mean, I never heard anyone say, well, I was kidnapped. I mean, I never saw anyone really right. taking up that role
yeah.
as I don't even know what to say, but almost like a leader or like a banner carrier in that space. I mean, I was also pretty young. Yeah. You could say I lived under a rock kind of, yeah. I lived in my own little bubble,
yeah.
but I just had never really seen that before. And I feel like these crimes of kidnapping and sexual assault and sexual exploitation, they are so individual, mm-hmm. so much pain and emotion. One person goes through so much pain and so much emotion that it's hard to think that possibly anyone else out there could understand mm-hmm. what you're going through. So I feel like it's a very isolating crimes that happen. And I mean, it's scary. Of course it's scary to come forward. Of course it's scary to talk about the worst moments of your life or your most vulnerable moments. And so seeing this sofa full of survivors being oh yeah, I remember that. And then also kind of recognizing that all of us were in different stages of our healing journey, if you will. I almost don't even like that word because yes, hopefully you are healing. Yes, it's a journey. It's not a destination, but it's also just life.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all just doing the best that we can and seeing where we're all at in life. I mean, it was just illuminating, for lack of a different word. And just recognizing that trauma affects each one of us so differently. And there's no time frame that you can say, well, it's been 6 years, it's been 20 years, it's been 18, whatever. There is no okay, I made it to the 10-year mark, life is perfect, let's keep going, or made it to the 20-year mark, whoop-de-doo, was that even my life? I mean, there just is no rule of thumb that you can hold any timeline to. And it was just fascinating and incredible. And, you know, I have no idea if Jamie Kloss ever saw that. But to me personally, that was very powerful. And just having a visual instead of just words on a piece of paper in different seats.
Yeah.
It really struck me.
I agree. And I think that everyone that was in that room, from, you know, the production to support persons, everyone that was in that room really felt the power of that moment. And I think that a lot of us underestimated how impactful that was going to be, because when you reached out and said, I have this idea, I would like for you to participate. And this is what it looks like. We're going to go and sit down, you know, a group of survivors, and we're going to lend our experience and our support to Jamie Kloss. And we're just going to kind of talk about our experiences. I thought, okay, yeah, that will be really neat. And what I experienced in that moment was that I was healed through that situation in a way that I didn't even realize I was hurting. And I think it was this isolation that you talk about. And it made me realize in that moment that I had something very unique in that opportunity. And that was to sit down with people who truly understood what I had been through on like a soul level and could speak the words that sometimes I didn't even know I was feeling. And this was actually kind of at the beginning of what I would deem my healing journey, right? And this was like 15 years removed from my kidnapping, because for at least 15 years, I told myself, I'm not impacted. And so it really kind of was the spark for me that ignited my healing and realizing that so many people who have been victimized will not have a similar opportunity where they're able to sit down. And it's what kind of has driven me to do everything else. So I'm eternally grateful that you asked me to do that. And I think that was something very powerful that I just would love to see happen more, because someone can listen to that, they can see it. And maybe Jamie hasn't seen it, but other people have. And mm-hmm. other people will see similarities in what we experienced and find support. So I found that to be very powerful. And I'm so glad that I got to be a part of it.
Well, and Kara, I think about all the tons of times that you've drawn back to that point and you reference being in that room, exchanging those knowing looks with those same women. And what an incredible opportunity. I wish there was a way to have other people feel that, even if they can't be on that same sofa, to be able to bring them in and to let them know that all of these experiences that you're having, even for as individual and as isolating as these crimes are valid. That you aren't alone in that, even though you know, these crimes make you feel as if you are. And I just wish that there was some way that we could tangibly put that out into the world, that there's this incredible community of us who can give you the look, even if we're not looking directly in your eyes, that we know and can have those conversations without exchanging words.
Well, be it from me, from being wrong or going out on a limb or anything, but I would venture to say that you are probably achieving that very goal by doing this podcast and by pursuing it. Oh. Well done to both of you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. That is definitely our goal. And I mean, I would love to see something like that regularly occurring, you know, with like a rotating staff or what have you. I think, you know, something like Red Table Talks, which you did.
Oh. Yeah.
What was that experience like?
That was great. It was a really good experience. I mean, it felt, I suppose, validating to a degree, because it's easy to be involved in this work and then go home at night and be like, am I even making a difference? Like, it's not like statistics are going down at all.
Right.
I mean, if anything, they're just going up. And I'm sure, well, actually, I hope you haven't, but I know I certainly have received criticism over the years because, I mean, I'm not blonde haired right now, but, no. You know, the vast majority of my life, I've been blonde haired and I'm white. White is like white as snow. Like I'm as white as you can get. And like people have been like, well, that's the only reason why your story was picked up so much. Because, you know, you're white, you came from a nice family, you came from like a nice neighborhood. And honestly, there's probably an actual element of truth. There's an element of truth in that. But for me, being able to go on Red Table Talks, it was another really special experience to me, because although I might be white, my interest has never just been focused on white missing women or girls. And I have worked trying to change that, but it's, you know, it's hard. It's a hard world we live in. It's difficult. And so being able to go on to Red Table Talks, and we were able to highlight different families who their stories never made it across probably any media personnel's desk, or, you know, just never got any coverage, local or national. I mean, it felt important to be doing that.
Yeah. And I know you have done through your foundation, through your nonprofit. I know you've done a lot of work raising awareness of different people that look different than us, because I agree, there has been criticism. And even sometimes when I look at that conversation that we did, you know, the photo of all of us on the couch, I'm like, oh my gosh, we literally were all blonde at that moment. Like even Gina, like we were all blonde at that moment. And I was like, oh, that's so painful sometimes. So I love that you got that situation where you got to be validated and you've been doing this work in your foundation. Because I know you did a drive at one point with your foundation, raising awareness for Indigenous people and missing women, Native American descent. And so I know that you've done a lot of work. So I just want to, you know, commend you and say you are doing awesome things and work matters. And we're so glad that you are here doing things and that you are a survivor.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, you know, as I've gone forward in my advocacy and as I've met other people and you don't know what you don't know. And initially, I didn't know a whole lot. And so now, realizing just how little I actually know, I mean, it's just been overwhelming, and recognizing that really there is more that needs to be done mm-hmm. for everyone. Mm-hmm. So onwards we go.
So one of the things that I would love to have you speak to is the fact that we live in this true crime genre, whether we want to or not. All of us have stories that people love to pick up, yours probably most of all, because I think a lot of content creators don't necessarily see survivors as people, they see them as content. So between you and Kara, I think especially, tell us a little bit about what that is like when you're scrolling through your feed or you see something pop up on YouTube and you're like, that's me and I have no idea what this is about.
I feel like it's always been that way for me. I mean, my story was so publicized, and it was before the time of really of Facebook or social media, or I mean, the world wasn't all consumed by the internet and the different platforms back then that it is now. And I think most people got their entertainment and their news from the news on TV. And my story, as far as I know, as far as I understand, it did saturate local and national news for a very long time. And so I feel like that's been a bit of a double-edged sword. Because do I credit it partially for helping in my rescue? Yes, I do. And I would not want to bite the hand that feeds me, bite the hand that rescues me, if you know what I'm saying. But at the same time, I would also say that the hardest thing for me after was coming to understand that I would never be able to go back to being the Elizabeth Smart that I was pre-kidnapping. That I'd never just be able to go back to 14-year-old Elizabeth Smart, that my life was forever changed. And in the early days, I mean, it was more like newspapers, articles that would the journalist have liked to have talked to me? Probably. But I mean, I was 14, 15, like I wasn't doing anything. Like yeah. I didn't do anything at the time. So I wasn't going to go speak to someone. I mean, I was still a kid. And, like when I'd see stuff or if people wrote mean things about me or about my case or about my family, I mean, I took it really personally and it hurt a lot. I mean, you know, when someone criticizes you, when does it not hurt?
Right.
Publicly or privately, like whenever someone's mean to you, of course it hurts. Mm-hmm. And then I'd get caught up reading the comments after. And I was like, oh my goodness, people actually think that about me. Like they think I ran away or like I didn't want to be rescued. Like, are you serious? Like I would get so caught up in the comments. And I remember just, I'd feel so bad about it. And one day my older brother, he was just like, Elizabeth, he's like, you've got to stop reading the comments. I mean, think about the people who are probably writing those comments. Okay. They're probably like the losers that never got a job, never moved out of their mom's house, living in their basement, so unhappy with their own life that all they can do is try to tear down other people. Those are the kind of people who are probably commenting on these articles. He's like, so don't read them and stop paying attention to them. And actually, I felt like that was pretty good advice because then I stayed away, as far away from yeah. any kind of article, any kind of media clip, anything that had to do with me. And I don't know if that became force of habit or that was just my way of dealing with things. But I feel like I did a fairly good job of that, actually. But I mean, it's like, on one hand, I feel powerless, if you will, because like this is my life and nobody else was experiencing what I experienced with me, yet everyone has an opinion and they're going out with their opinion, even though they weren't even there. Yeah. And on the other hand, I'm just like, all right, well, I'm not even going to emotionally engage in this because I will never win. I won't be able to take back what's already been put out there. And so I guess I can only hope that my story gets so saturated that nobody wants to talk about it ever again. And that is going to be the way to reclaim my privacy.
So since you don't have that privacy, though, yeah. Go ahead, Kara.
I was going to say, one of the things that you have done, though, is that you have taken ownership over your story and told it in a way that you were proud of. And this is one of the things that I have kind of taken a page out of your book, whether it's, you know, you wrote your book, literally you wrote your own book and you yes. executive produced your story, right? And that inspired me to say, you know what? I want to tell my story in a way that I'm proud of. And I want to be an executive producer of these projects so that it can be something that I can stand behind. And so, you know, for anyone who doesn't know, whenever I was ready to do a documentary and any other project that I've wanted to do, I generally go to Elizabeth first and I'm like, hey, I don't know anything about the world of making a documentary, but I know you do. So who do you recommend? And so I feel like you have kind of set the standard. So can you talk a little bit about what it was like to say, I want to do a documentary. I am willing to do a movie about my story, but I want to be involved in the process because I don't feel like that is very normal. That's mm-hmm. not the standard of these kind of things. So I want to hear you talk about that a little bit and what that's been like. Yes.
So initially when I got home, I mean, my parents came out with a book. My uncle came out with a book. Other people came out with books or included my story in their books. And I was, frankly, I was pissed. Like, I was not happy. I didn't want my parents to write a book. I did not want anyone to write a book. I felt like, well, who do you think you are? Like, did this happen to you? Were you on the other side? No, you weren't. So how can you even write that? Anyway, we don't even need to get into that. Like, it's water under the bridge now. It is what it is. It's done and it's
in the past. But it's not an uncommon feeling. Like, I think that many people feel that way. Right? It's like, why are you telling my story?
Even if it's not on that grandiose of a scale too, you have people who, you know, maybe they experience a sex assault with a dating partner and they have a big group of mutual friends. And then you have them telling other people in your small friend group, but that's that spotlight effect, right? Where it feels so small and like everyone knows this about you, but it's not always blown up in, you know, bestsellers or national media. But I think that probably resonates with most people who have gone through this and other people talk about their story without their permission or without knowing them as a person in general.
Yeah. Yeah. So tell us about
it. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Well, so when I got home, I mean, I was like, I'm never writing a book. I'm never doing a movie, never doing a documentary. Like, I don't want to talk about this ever again. Leave me alone. And that was exactly how I felt. And honestly, I'd go out and advocate for different laws, different legislation. Like, I would be involved that way, but I didn't go out and publicly speak about my story. I mean, I didn't sit and say like what happened I didn't speak about it at all. And I really did not speak about it for years, actually, until my case finally came to trial, which was, 8 years later, you know, the better part of a decade. And when it finally went to trial, I remember being up on the witness stand and then like asking me all sorts of questions, things that I had never spoken about to anyone. And I was up there and I answered truthfully. I said what happened. And then I remember the next day going into the grocery store and there were like the tabloids by the checkout stand and my face was on all of them. And it was like, Elizabeth Smart admits she's a drug addict or a secret alcoholic. And I was like, are you kidding
me? Jesus, take the wheel.
And so kind of at that point, I was like, no, I did not go through all of this to be a tabloid magazine cover. Like, no. So since I've had to put my story, like intimate details of my life that I never wanted to talk about out there for the world to see during this trial, I'm not just going to let someone else come along and rip those details and make of it what they want. I'm going to set the record straight. Yes, I gave a lot of details of what happened, but I wasn't necessarily given the chance to include context or anything else. So I'm going to set the record straight. Like, I'm going to do a book and it's going to be my story. And it's going to have what led up to this, you know, why this even happened, how it made me feel, why maybe from the outside it looked like I was complicit, whereas in the inside I was thinking, I'm doing this to survive. If I don't do this, I might not survive. I'm going to include all these things that I never had the chance to say while I had to like spew all these facts about my life. And so writing my book, it really was, I felt like, setting the record straight. And then also it was, I guess, my way to reach out to other survivors and let them know that they're not alone. That was like my, I don't want to say gift to the world because that sounds really big-headed.
No, it doesn't.
But
absolutely.
I mean, I felt like it was my olive branch to other survivors to know that they're not alone.
I don't think that that's wrong at all. I think it is an incredible gift that you offered anyone who needed it, anyone willing to listen. It's not like you're shoving it down people's throats, but my goodness, how many people did that impact on such an international scale? I don't think that you should undercut that by any means. You did an incredible thing. Kara,
yes,
yours specifically, because you didn't go through the court system, you didn't have to disclose a lot of those details. Can the two of you talk a little bit about what that was like? Because Elizabeth, you would have had 8 years where you didn't have to disclose those. Did you choose to certain people, or would you rather have had it where I don't have to talk about all of these details in that setting, especially because court isn't like stand up, talk. Well, how did this make you feel? Offer context. It is. These are the facts that we have already decided are legal and applicable to this case and this context you can't bring in because we decided on motions. And there's all these behind the scenes things that people aren't going to tune in and watch on court TV, right? So between the two of you, what do you feel like some of those differences and commonalities are since you did have different outcomes there?
I feel like we've...
Kara, you want to take the lead on this?
I feel like we've kind of...
loaded question.
Yeah. I feel like we've kind of had this conversation in some ways because... we both, and I think, Kim, you identify with this as well. Something that you said earlier, Elizabeth, is I just wanted to just be Elizabeth Smart. Like, I didn't want to be Elizabeth Smart, the girl that was kidnapped, right? Like, I just wanted to be Elizabeth Smart, a teenage girl, and, like, go back to life. And that was me, too. I just wanted everyone to treat me the same on July 1st as they'd had on June 1st, right? Like, I wanted them to treat me the same. And so... for me, I was happy to tell people the details if they needed to know it, but I didn't really think that it was necessary. And so when my captor killed himself, for me, I was pissed off. I was extremely angry for a very long time. But then there was the moment that I realized as I got older and a little more mature, and someone had written a book about my captor and included some of the details from the incident report. And my father picked up that book, right? And read things in that book that I was like, we didn't have a trial. So I got to protect my father from having that information, right? So I realized that by not having a trial, my parents never had to sit in a courtroom and listen to, okay, what about this time that you were assaulted? And what about the time that he did this? And, you know, we're charging your offender with X number of sexual assault charges. So for me, I got to kind of protect that information. And I know for you, you did not have that opportunity. So that must have been so difficult. You did have a good amount of time, like you said, to kind of process it. But those years in between, you got to protect that information. And then what did it look like and feel like on trial? I mean, that must have just been so difficult.
I mean, it wasn't easy. Yeah. Like, and I sat through the whole trial, and like, I remember listening to other people going up and like giving their testimony. And I just remember thinking, like, pardon my French, but what the hell, like, who the hell are you?
Right.
Like, what do you think gives you the right to talk about this? You weren't there.
And why, don't it, know. Why does it matter? Like, why would anyone else's testimony matter? Right. Like,
yeah. Like, I just remember I had actually been out of the country. I was serving a Mormon mission in France. I was in France for a year and a half, and I had to come back from France to be interviewed by the FBI, the prosecution team, in preparation for the trial. I went back to France, and then I was called back again for the actual trial. And I was at home for about 6 weeks, because that was about how long the trial went on for. And then I went back to France. And I mean, we could spend a lot of time dissecting my time in France, because it's not like a normal existence as a Mormon missionary. It's not. There's quite a lot of strict rules that you have to live
That's
by.
That's a different podcast.
That's a different podcast. But like, it was just one extreme to the other. I mean, quite literally one extreme to the other. It was a bit like whiplash. And it was hard. And there were moments where I was so frustrated and just angry. And I mean, these were things that I never wanted to speak about. Like, I never wanted to voice them, because voicing them, if I didn't talk about it, it was almost like I could pretend like they didn't happen.
Yes.
But putting a voice to it in such a public place, where every word that came out of my mouth, there was a record that was being kept of everything that I said and could go on to become public information. I mean, that was, and I didn't feel like I had a choice. I mean, I could have left right after my testimony was over, but I just remember sitting there thinking, oh, I'm not leaving until this thing is done. Like,
yes.
No more of this back and forth. Like, I will be here until the verdict comes back.
Mm-hmm.
And I was. I don't think that there is like a best case scenario in any of this, because listening to Kara speak about her experience, for me, for years, I used to just think, oh, I just wish both my captors could have just died.
Yeah.
I want them both dead. And then, you know, as I've listened to other people's perspectives and Kara's perspective, you know, where like her captor, it was almost like he took the easy way out. Like, he didn't have to take accountability for what he did.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not right.
Right.
There is no good outcome for survivors.
Yep.
Like, there really isn't. Whether you have your day in court or not, there is no best practices, because no matter what, these people who have hurt you, who have raped you, I mean, they've taken parts of your life that you will never get back. And like, no court ruling could ever give you back that time of your life, or those parts of your life that have been taken, or like that innocence or that childhood. Like, no court can give that back to you. Death can't give that back to you. I mean, there's just nothing out there that can replace what has been taken from you. And I mean, my goodness, to think that only 25 out of every 1,000 perpetrators who are actually reported actually get, are actually convicted.
Yep.
25 out of 1,000, there's only 25 convictions.
Yeah.
Like, that's horrendous.
Yeah.
Victims are not, they don't get justice ever, no matter what the outcome is.
Yeah.
So all in all, I mean, I wouldn't say it's not worth fighting for. It's not worth going after. It's not worth reporting. I would never say that. I mean, if you feel like this is what you want to do, you're ready to do it 100%. Because the only way you will ever be able to make change is when there are enough voices yelling and screaming and angry and making a fuss so that the world can't turn its back on us. So if you want to report, I am right behind you. I'm with you all the way. But go in with the expectation that what has been taken from you will not be given back. Mm-hmm. And it's probably going to be a difficult road, but it doesn't mean that you shouldn't go after it.
I'm glad that you brought up that statistic, because I was actually thinking about it, and I was thinking about the three of us sitting here, and we actually are in the minority, and that we had some sort of resolution to our assault. And that, I would assume, is primarily because we're all victims of strangers who were our offenders, right? And so one of the things that we talk about is this whole idea that, you know, basically, you know, less than 25 out of 1,000, right? So that makes less than 2% of offenders, or around 2% of offenders that serve jail time. So one of the things that I often find myself talking to people about when they're very frustrated with it, I'm like, it is very frustrating. And coming from, you know, having worked in law enforcement, I actually can see why those percentages are so low. Unless you get a confession from the offender, or, you know, unless you have evidence and it's a stranger type of situation, they are very difficult to prosecute. So very often I find myself telling people, yes, it, like you said, Elizabeth, if prosecution is something you want, absolutely go after it, but you cannot hang your healing and your identity on that prosecution. You have to find it outside of the justice system, because, you know, you could have something like you go through this whole big trial and then there's not a conviction, or you can have something like what you've recently had to deal with, Elizabeth, where one of your captors is out of jail, right?
Yes. And very selfishly, I totally want to talk to you about this if you are willing.
Go ahead.
Talk about it. You can say no.
It's fine.
Because I know that this is more one of those fresh things. As new things develop, you look at it like, oh, okay, we can close this. It's done. I get to move on with my life. And then just like that, you've got something else that comes back up. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Were you informed prior to her release? Like, did any victim?
No.
Oh, God. Okay. So,
I mean, when you say like informed, are you saying like in 6 months your captor will be released? Like, this is a official note? Like, no, like that? No, it was maybe like the day before I got a phone call and it was like, oh, hey, actually, which was crazy because it had only been a few months earlier that, or it felt like a few months, maybe it was a year. I don't know.
Time.
Like,
it's an illusion.
Time
blindness.
Well, I mean, I felt like I had just recently been headed down for a parole hearing.
Yeah.
And then it was just like, it felt like it was, I don't know, maybe a couple months later, all of a sudden she was being released. And I remember just being like, wait, what?
Right.
Like, I thought I was under the impression that you were not getting out. Mm-hmm. And now you're out. So, I mean, it was a surprise.
Yeah. I ask because that is the situation that I find myself in now with my attacker. He was sentenced in 2007. So we have indeterminate sentencing in Colorado for sex assaults, and he was sentenced to 12 years to life for that specific count. I didn't realize that the truth in sentencing here is that there is none. And I started getting those form emails just out of the blue after about, what did I say, 12 years, somewhere in there. And they were just a gut punch. It wasn't a call. It wasn't anything personal. It was just out of the blue. Here's an email that, hey, by the way, he's eligible for community corrections. If you want to say something, you can. And it was completely opposite of the experience that I'd had with law enforcement and prosecution. And now, after having gone to 2 parole hearings, we have our next one coming up here next month, actually. And he has done absolutely no treatment, no sex offender specific treatment. And yet we still have to go down and testify and speak to either a parole board member or the entire board as to why he should stay in prison. When you're going back to those statistics about, hey, here's 3 of us that have offenders that either are incarcerated or there's a conclusion where they have unalived, you're looking at least 300 that didn't have that conclusion. Looking at it statistically. Now, the other one that comes back to mind from EVAW, you can look these up on In Violence Against Women International. Every offender, they have at least 6 victims over the course of their lifetime. So how many more people are you putting out into the world with those dark reporting numbers because people just don't want to talk about it, or they don't even realize that what happened to them was a sex assault, was abuse, was child molestation, all of these things that you don't even know. And to have someone like that taking up the time, space, energy without any kind of treatment or really any ability to take responsibility at all is frightening. And it's indicative of a bigger systematic issue.
100%. I couldn't agree with you more. I don't think it's impossible to change. However, I think it's next to impossible to change. And when it's involving like this serious of a crime, I don't believe in second chances for this kind of crime. I just don't.
Yeah.
And I feel like if more survivors were in positions of authority, power, then we would see a change.
Oh, I agree with that 100%. So I want to switch gears just a little bit, because as we were talking, I was reminded of a question that I get asked a lot that I don't ever really know how to answer. And I'm sure you get asked often too. So I'd be curious to hear your response, because you have children, they are getting older, and they are a lot more savvy, these children these days. And my children have done things like talk to the Google speaker and like, you know, ask who is, and then like their name and who is Kara Chamberlain, and Google gave an answer. And so I'm curious if you've experienced anything like that, first of all. But second of all, the question that I get asked very often is, do your children know your story, and how do you talk to them about that? Because I don't know if I'm doing it right. I don't think there is a right way to do it, but I think that this is a question that a lot of people will have who have been through difficult things. Like, at what point and how do I tell my children what happened to me? And especially if you're out there, you know, you're out there, right? So your kids are going to come across it on YouTube, or
my kids found me on Google Slides. Like,
you know, it's funny that you actually say that, because my little boy just came up to me like 2 days ago and was like, "Mom, why didn't you tell me you're famous?" And I was like, "What?" What? He's like, "Why wouldn't you tell me that?" And I was like,
yeah.
Sweetheart, like,
oh, sweet boy.
Like, what do you think famous means, honey?
Yeah. Bless.
But I mean, I feel like I'm still trying to figure that out, but I guess the best advice I was given that I am trying to follow is that when they ask questions, that is the time to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, it's hard, because on one hand, I don't want to take away like their innocence and the way that they look at the world. Mm-hmm. And I don't want them to be scared to ride their bike or go to sleep at night or go to school. I don't want them to live in fear. At the same time, like, I want them to be empowered and educated. So you're asking the impossible question, which, yes, you're absolutely right. Everyone does ask me, and I'm like, I don't know. Do you know?
Open to suggestions.
pretty much. Yeah. So like, my oldest daughter, who's 7, like, she doesn't know details, but she could tell you like the overall story.
Yeah.
My little boy, I'm not sure what he knows, which I should probably go ahead and ask him.
Yeah.
And my youngest, I don't think she cares at all yet.
Brutal honesty. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And that's, I get asked that often, and the details that essentially my children know at this age, they're 9 and 6, is that someone took me from my mommy and daddy when I was younger. But I do wonder how many other things they've picked up, because they are like, their children are so insightful and they take in so much more than we realize. And so again, I'm like, am I doing it right? I'm not sure. But I do have to say that you have put out content that has changed the way I view my children and their safety, because I have 2 little boys, and I foolishly fell into this trap for a lot of their childhood of, well, I don't have to be as protective of them. Like, they're boys. And then one day I sort of just woke up, and I think I was listening to a podcast that you did, and you'll have to remind me of if this, you know, strikes a memory for you of who it was, but there was a statistic of how boys are almost just as likely to be victims of a sexual assault. And I was like, I know that. Like, I actually know that. But I had fallen into this trap, even as a public survivor who's out here doing this advocacy work of like, well, I don't have to talk to my boys the same. And then I've realized that I do have to protect them, but I also have to be very aware of not raising offenders, which is like it's a hard thing to admit as a survivor. But I'm curious if you've had those kind of revelations and moments as a mother of girls and boys.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like I've been pretty consistent with talking to my kids about what's appropriate, what's not appropriate. Like, if I give them rules, I feel like and they don't like the rules, I feel like I am pretty consistent in being like, do you know why this is a rule in our home, in our family? And explaining to them the importance of being safe or what is appropriate contact between themselves and other people. I feel like for me personally, because I do live in this world so much of advocacy and survivorship, and I am living in it every day, that I do also catch myself when I come home, or I mean, a lot of time I work from home, but when like my work period is done, like, and I close my laptop or I like turn off my phone or whatever it is that I do to end that day, that I don't necessarily want to like actively think about it anymore because I've already thought about it for the last like 9 hours. And I just want to like live in like the safety, the cocoon of my home and my family. And I want to shut everything else off. And I just want to laugh and be happy and watch light, fluffy, silly stuff or currently Christmas movies or, you know, like just something that's like light and happy. And every now and then I will also be like, okay, as much as I don't want to like carry over like the emotion and like the hard things from working, I can't just like cut it off completely so that I'm not doing what I preach to everyone else to do, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Absolutely. You can't be advocating for the world and not for your own family.
Or like, right? Yeah. And I can't be like, yeah, you got to talk with your kids. You got to have this be a common theme. And then like me not be like, oh, it's been 9 months. Oh, it's been a year. Like I need to be like good with that as well. I mean, fortunately or not fortunately, I feel like my kids ask enough questions that it does come up fairly often. So sometimes I'm like, if it was just left on me and my kids never asked questions, then there might be some larger gaps between conversations, or the conversation might not be as ongoing. Like, I've noticed that about myself. So listen to your kids' questions, I guess is what I'm saying.
I think they're really good at, we maybe don't give them enough credit all the time for directing what they want to know, because you're right, they do ask questions. And I think so many times it's hard to be like, oh, like using Santa for an example. Oh, yeah, I don't know. He's at the North Pole, and you kind of push it to the side and don't address like really what's the heart of their question. And so, Elizabeth, our daughters are the same age. And I would say my kids in general probably know a little bit more than like their classmates and such, but it's a product of what we do, of what my husband does. And I actually think that it makes them more inquisitive about the things that they're told. I feel more comfortable about them going out into the world and being able to advocate for themselves. Not because I passed on my trauma to them, I didn't. It's because I made them aware of the fact that there are people out there who have different experiences, and that it's okay to use the correct terminology, which I'm perpetually a 12-year-old and snickering internally every time I have to say, like, penis, oh my God. Like, we need to be able to have those tough conversations so that, God forbid, if they have to have them, they are able to advocate for themselves and stick up for themselves in a way that people are going to understand. And I don't think that it's just us as survivors, but maybe it does have it further in the front of our minds.
Yeah. And actually, to your point, like, I used to internally snicker at penis and vagina too every time I had to say it. But now that I have like little kids, boy and girls, they're like, I smashed my penis in the toilet. Whatever. I'm like, why is your penis? Like, now they've become such common words. I could not care less. I'm like, is your vagina hurting? Is it okay? Like,
right.
I don't stick things up that. Yeah. Don't cut your penis in public, please. Stop sticking your hands down your pants, please.
The number of things. So as a strictly boy mom, the number of times I had to say things like, please get your penis off the table. Please stop rubbing your penis on my wall. And like, these are the conversations that you don't realize because there's no girls here. So they're just like laughing around all the time. And I'm like, guys, there's time and place, and it's not now. It is not now. It's just the beauty of parenting. But yeah,
it is very uncomfortable when you start, but then when it becomes not a dirty word, and it makes grandparents extremely uncomfortable when they're not used to
it. Oh my gosh, yes.
Why did your 2-year-old say chichina? And I'm like, well, because he knows what a vagina is and he can't say vagina. So he said, I have a penis and you have a chichina. And it is very uncomfortable.
Yeah, ours was vagina. So I'm glad to know that my kids aren't the only ones who struggled saying it.
I think it was China for a while, just the one.
Just one. It's just, you know, like these wonderful things of parenting.
Isn't it?
So,
but it does make you internally address, like, what am I uncomfortable with? Why am I uncomfortable? That's not something I want to pass on to my kids.
I could be wrong, but I think my kids have no shame when it comes to saying those vagina or penis. Same. So
good.
Same. I guess if I've done anything, it's that.
You know that they will know how to talk about their body parts correctly.
So, yes.
Way to go. Yeah.
So one of the questions that we always ask is, do you consume true crime content?
No.
Yeah. Same.
Nope. No,
we do not. No. And that's kind of what made us want to go into this whole thing is that we don't consume it. We've lived it. And so we want to create content that is true crime content, or it's about survivors, it's for survivors, and it's by survivors, because I think there's something very empowering in that. It's what I've experienced in being very hands-on and very involved in telling my own story through documentary, movie, like all of the things, is that you don't need to consume it in other ways. And you also become so much more aware of how many times stories are told in a way that wasn't necessarily ethical. And yes. It makes you not want to consume it even more.
Oh,
you know,
well,
like I think there was so much down some of it that I would be like, oh, maybe I do want to watch this. And then I would find out that the victim didn't consent. And I'm like, oh, absolutely not.
Well, mm-hmm. I feel like it. I mean, it's not even just done that for me with true crime, but even like, so my husband and I, we've been watching The Crown. And I mean, of course, everyone has an opinion or writes, oh, that Buckingham Palace is not happy with this, or this is not accurate, or close friends of the royal, like whatever, you know, they have their opinion.
Yeah.
And, you know, as we've watched it, like this is not crime. Like it's
no, but it's based on
dramatized.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't even know what category it falls on. But I mean, even watching that, I mean, it has made me be like, you know what? I don't know how much of this is true. Was that how it happened? I don't know. You know, that'd be quite a surreal experience, like having a hugely popular series being put on about your family and your family history, and yet you have like no say over it or control over it.
So, right. Wait, are you guys binging this? Because I did.
We haven't binged it. We've watched it along, but I mean, like, honestly, it does. It's like, it does give me sympathy for them, because I'm like, man, you know what? They're probably put in some pretty, pretty impossible situations. But then, like, as now as I watch any movie, any documentary, any show that's based on actual events or actual people, I'm always like, unless that person is directly involved in it, I'm always like, but is it true?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then like, should I be consuming it? Because there's the Mike Tyson story that he wasn't involved in that has been done. And there's Pam and Tommy, right? Like mm-hmm. two big ones, and they were not involved in that process. And so I think it does, it makes you more aware.
Yeah.
You know who I look to as well for kind of like a guidepost here, Monica Lewinsky, when she is involved as an EP or a producer, I am far more willing to listen to that account of it, because talk about victimization that was absolutely taken in a different direction for political purposes. That is a whole other soapbox that we can
I'll put a pin in that one. But the one that she just did was, I think it was on FX. She talked about it. Hey, they approached me because, well, we're making it. Do you want to be a part of it? We're going to make it with or without you. And she's like, well, I might as well be a part of it so that it's accurate. And that one was one that I will watch this through the lens of her having a say in it, because otherwise I'm just not interested.
Yeah. No, I mean, yes. So I guess moral of this story is, unless the actual person or people involved have some kind of connection to it, just take everything you watch or consume with a grain of salt and recognize that there's probably things that are not completely accurate in there.
Yes. And for all you listening at home, this is the part of the Survivor's Guide to True Crime book that you're going to highlight and put a post-it on and come back to over and over.
Yes. Yes. One last question. We always like to leave our listeners with a call to action. So where can they find you? Where can they follow you? And if they would like to give back, support you in any way, shape, or form, how can they do that?
Of course, I'm on social media, Elizabeth Smart Official. I have a blue check next to my name on Instagram. I have my foundation, the Elizabeth Smart Foundation, which you can also find on Instagram or elizabethsmartfoundation.org. We have also merged with another foundation called the Malouf Foundation, and that's M-A-L-O-U-F, and that's malouffoundation.org, or they're on Instagram, social media as well. So go ahead and give us a follow. Go check out our website. We've got a number of different educational programs that we offer, and a lot of them are for free. One of them is I Am on Watch, which is free. Yes. It takes you probably about an hour to do the whole training, but it's just a little series of little videos that will help you recognize the signs of human trafficking and abuse and what to watch for and what to do. So if you haven't taken that and you have an hour to spare, or 10 minutes a day, or just a few minutes a day, make your way through that training and get educated, become informed.
Yes. So many good resources there. So thank you so much for your time. We are so grateful that you joined us. And I have a feeling that we will have other conversations in the future.
I would only hope so.
Thank you so, so much. This has been great. Survivor's Guide to True Crime is hosted and executive produced by Kimberly Corbin Rourke and Kara Robinson Chamberlain.
If you love what we do here, please don't forget to follow, rate, and review the show in your podcast player. It's an easy and free way to help us and help more people find the show.
To learn more about the guests featured or to find resources and information discussed on the show, visit survivorsguidetotruecrime.com.
Thanks for listening.
Well, see you later.